bonfire.
A bonfire? Said the priest. It was hot on the hillside.
After dark,
said Kassad.
We want the wind wagon to know we're here. Now let's move.
It was a quiet group that watched the powered launch move downriver at sunset. Even from 2 kilometers away, the consul could see the blue skins of the crew. The Benares looked old and abandoned at its wharf, already a part of the deserted city. When the launch was lost in the distance, the group turned to watch the sea of grass. Long shadows from the river bluffs crept out across what the consul already found himself thinking of as the surf and shallows. Farther out, the sea seemed to shift in color, the grass mellowing to an aquamarine shimmer before darkening to a hint of verdurous depths. The lapis sky melted into the reds and golds of sunset, illuminating their hilltop and setting the pilgrim skins aglow with liquid light. The only sound was the whisper of wind in grass.
"We've got a fucking huge heap of baggage,"
Martin Silenus said loudly.
"For a bunch of folks on a one-way trip."
It was true, thought the consul. Their luggage made a small mountain on the grassy hilltop.
"Somewhere in there,"
came the quiet voice of Hetmastine,
"may lie our salvation."
"What do you mean?"
"Yeah,"
said Martin Silenus, lying back, putting his hands under his head and staring at the sky.
"Did you bring a pair of undershorts that are shrike-proof?"
The Templar shook his head slowly. The sudden twilight cast his face in shadow under the cowl of the robe.
"Let us not trivialize or dissemble. It is time to admit that each of us has brought on this pilgrimage something which he or she hopes will alter the inevitable outcome when the moment arrives that we must face the Lord of Pain."
The poet laughed.
"I didn't even bring my lucky fucking rabbit's foot."
The Templar's hood moved slightly.
"But your manuscript, perhaps?"
The poet said nothing. Hetmastine moved his invisible gaze to the tall man on his left.
"And you, Colonel, there are several trunks which bear your name. Weapons, perhaps?"
Kassad raised his head but did not speak.
"Of course. It would be foolish to go hunting without a weapon."
"What about me?"
asked Braun Lamia, folding her arms.
"Do you know what secret weapon I've smuggled along?"
The Templar's oddly accented voice was calm.
"We have not yet heard your tale, M. Lamia. It would be premature to speculate."
"What about the consul?"
"Oh, yes. It is obvious what weapon our diplomatic friend has in store."
The consul turned from his contemplation of the sunset.
"I brought only some clothes and 2 books to read,"
he said truthfully.
"Ah,"
sighed the Templar.
"But what a beautiful spacecraft you left behind."
Martin Silenus jumped to his feet.
"The fucking ship! You can call it, can't you? Well, goddammit, get your dog whistle out. I'm tired of sitting here."
The consul pulled a strand of grass and stripped it. After a minute, he said,
"Even if I could call it, and you heard Abetic say that the commsats and repeater stations were down, even if I could call it, we couldn't land north of the Bridal Range. That meant instant disaster even before the Shrike began ranging south of the mountains."
"Yeah,"
said Silenus, waving his arms in agitation.
"But we could get across this fucking lawn. Call the ship."
"Wait until morning. If the wind wagon's not here, we will discuss alternatives."
"Fuck that,"
began the poet, but Kassad stepped forward, with his back to him, effectively removing Silenus from the circle.
"Emmestine, what is your secret?"
There was enough light from the dying sky to show a slight smile on the Templar's thin lips. He gestured toward the mound of baggage.
"As you see, my trunk is the heaviest and most mysterious of all."
"It's a Mobius cube," said Father Hoyt. "I've seen ancient artifacts transported that way."
"Or fusion bombs,"
said Kassad. Hetmastine shook his head.
Nothing so crude.
Are you going to tell us?
When it is my turn to speak.
Are you next?
Asked the consul.
We can listen while we wait.
Saul Weintraub cleared his throat.
I have number 4,
he said, showing the slip of paper.
But I would be more than pleased to trade with the true voice of the tree.
Weintraub lifted Rachel from his left shoulder to his right, patting her gently on the back. Hetmastine shook his head.
No, there is time. I meant only to point out that in hopelessness there is always hope. We have learned much from the story so far, yet each of us has some seed of promise buried even deeper than we have admitted.
I don't see, began Father Hoyt, but was interrupted by Martin Silenus's sudden shout.
It's the wagon, the fucking wind wagon, here at last.
It was another 20 minutes before the wind wagon tied up to one of the wharves. The craft came out of the north, its sails white squares against a dark plain draining of color. The last light had faded by the time the large ship had tacked close to the low bluff, folded its mainsails, and rolled to a stop. The consul was impressed. The thing was wooden, handcrafted, and huge, curved in the pregnant lines of some seagoing galleon out of old Earth's ancient history. The single gigantic wheel, set in the center of the curving hull, normally would have been invisible in the 2-meter-tall grass. But the consul caught a glimpse of the underside as he carried luggage onto the wharf. From the ground it would be 6 or 7 meters to the railing, and more than 5 times that height to the tip of the mainmast. From where he stood, panting from exertion, the consul could hear the snap of pennants far above and a steady, almost subsonic hum that would be coming from either the ship's interior flywheel or its massive gyroscopes. A gangplank extruded from the upper hull and lowered itself to the wharf. Father Hoyt and Braun Lamia had to step back quickly or be crushed. The wind wagon was less well lighted than the Benares. Illumination appeared to consist of several lanterns hanging from spars. No crew had been visible during the approach of the ship, and no one came into view now.
Hello!
Called the consul from the base of the gangplank. No one answered.
Wait here a minute, please,
said Kassad, and mounted the long ramp in 5 strides. The others watched while Kassad paused at the top, touched his belt where the small death wand was tucked, and then disappeared amidships. Several minutes later, a light flared through broad windows at the stern, casting trapezoids of yellow on the grass below.
Come up,
called Kassad from the head of the ramp.
It's empty.
The group struggled with their luggage, making several trips. The consul helped Hetmastine with the heavy Mobius trunk, and through his fingertips he could feel a faint but intense vibration.
So where the fuck is the crew?
Asked Martin Silenus when they were assembled on the foredeck. They had taken their single-file tour through the narrow corridors and cabins, down stairways more ladder than stairs, and through cabins not much bigger than the built-in bunks they contained. Only the rearmost cabin, the captain's cabin, if that is what it was, approached the size and comfort of standard accommodations on the Benares.
It's obviously automated,
said Kassad. The force officer pointed to halyards which disappeared into slots in the deck, manipulators all but invisible among the rigging and spars, and the subtle hint of gears halfway up the lateen-rigged rear mast.
I didn't see a control center, not so much as a disky or C-spot nexus.
She slipped her comm log from a breast pocket and tried to interface on standard data, comm, and biomed frequencies. There was no response from the ship.
The ships used to be crewed,
said the consul.
Temple initiates used to accompany the pilgrims to the mountains.
Well, they're not here now, said Hoyt. But I guess we can assume that someone is still alive at the tram station or Keep Kronos. They sent the wagon for us.
Or everyone's dead and the wind wagon is running on an automatic schedule.
She looked over her shoulder as rigging and canvas creaked in a sudden gust of wind.
Damn, it's weird to be cut off from everybody and everything like this. It's like being blind and deaf. I don't know how colonials stand it.
Martin Silenus approached the group and sat on the railing. He drank from a long green bottle and said,
"Where's the poet? Show him. Show him, muses mine, that I may know him. 'Tis the man who with a man is an equal, be he king or poorest of the beggar class, or any other wondrous thing a man may be twixt ape and Plato. 'Tis the man who with a bird, wren, or eagle finds his way to all its instincts. He hath heard the lion's roaring, and can tell what his horny throat expresseth. And to him the tiger's yell comes articulate, and presseth on his ear like mother tongue."
"Where did you get that wine bottle?"
asked Kassad. Martin Silenus smiled. His eyes were small and bright in the lantern glow.
"The galley's fully stocked, and there's a bar. I declare it open."
"We should fix some dinner,"
said the consul. Although all he wanted at the moment was some wine, it had been more than 10 hours since they had last eaten. There came a clank and whir, and all six of them moved to the starboard rail. The gangplank had drawn itself in. They whirled again as canvas unfurled, lines grew taut, and somewhere a flywheel hummed into the ultrasonic. Sails filled, the deck tilted slightly, and the wind wagon moved away from the wharf and into the darkness. The only sounds were the flap and creak of the ship, the distant rumble of the wheel, and the rasp of grass on the hull bottom. The six of them watched as the shadow of the bluff fell behind, the unlighted beacon pyre receding as a faint gleam of starlight on pale wood. And then there were only the sky and night and swaying circles of lantern light.
"I'll go below," said the consul,
"and see if I can get a meal together."
The others stayed above a while, feeling the slight surge and rumble through the soles of their feet and watching darkness pass. The sea of grass was visible only as the place where stars ended and flat blackness began. Kassad used a hand beam to illuminate glimpses of canvas and rigging, lines being pulled tight by invisible hands, and then he checked all the corners and shadowed places from stern to bow. The others watched in silence. When he clicked the light off, the darkness seemed less oppressive, the starlight brighter. A rich, fertile smell, more of a farm in springtime than of the sea, came to them on a breeze which had swept across 1,000 kilometers of grass. Some time later, the consul called to them and they went below to eat. The galley was cramped and there was no mess table, so they used the large cabin in the stern as their common room, pushing 3 of the trunks together as a makeshift table. 4 lanterns swinging from low beams made the room bright. A breeze blew in when Hetmastine opened one of the tall windows above the bed. The consul set plates piled high with sandwiches on the largest trunk and returned again with thick white cups and a coffee therm. He poured while the others ate.
"This is quite good,"
said Fedman Kassad.
"Where did you get the roast beef?"
"The cold box is fully stocked. There's another large freezer in the aft pantry."
"Electrical?"
asked Hetmastine.
"No, double insulated."
Martin Silenus sniffed a jar, found a knife on the sandwich plate, and added great dollops of horseradish to his sandwich. His eyes sparkled with tears as he ate.
"How long does this crossing generally take?"
Lamia asked the consul. He looked up from his study of the circle of hot black coffee in his cup.
"I'm sorry, what?"
"Crossing the Sea of Grass? How long?"
"A night and a half a day to the mountains, if the winds are with us."
"And then? How long to cross the mountains?" asked Father Hoyt.
"Less than a day."
If the tramway is running,
added Kassad. The consul sipped the hot coffee and made a face.
We have to assume it is. Otherwise...
Otherwise what?
Otherwise,
said Colonel Kassad, moving to the open window and putting his hands on his hips.
We'll be stranded 600 clicks from the time tombs and 1,000 from the southern cities.
The consul shook his head.
No. The temple priests, or whoever are behind this pilgrimage, have seen to it that we've gotten this far. They'll make sure we go all the way.
Braun Lamia crossed her arms and frowned.
As what? Sacrifices?
Martin Silenus whooped a laugh and brought out his bottle.
Who are these coming to the sacrifice? To what green altar, O mysterious priest, leadst thou that heifer, lowing at the skies and all her silken flanks with garlands dressed? What little town by river or seashore or mountain built with peaceful citadel is emptied of its folk this pious morn? And little town, thy streets for evermore will silent be, and not a soul to tell why thou art desolate can e'er return.
Braun Lamia reached under her tunic and brought out a cutting laser no larger than her little finger. She aimed it at the poet's head.
You miserable little shit! One more word out of you and I swear I'll slag you where you stand!
The silence was suddenly absolute except for the background rumble groan of the ship. The consul moved toward Martin Silenus. Colonel Kassad took 2 steps behind Lamia. The poet took a long drink and smiled at the dark-haired woman. His lips were moist.
Oh, build your ship of death. Oh, build it.
Lamia's fingers were white on the pencil laser. The consul edged closer to Silenus, not knowing what to do, imagining the whipping beam of light fusing his own eyes. Kassad leaned toward Lamia like 2 meters of tense shadow.
Madam,
said Saul Weintraub from where he sat on the bunk against the far wall.
Need I remind you that there is a child present?
Lamia glanced to her right. Weintraub had removed a deep drawer from a ship's cupboard and had set it on the bed as a cradle. He had bathed the infant and come in silently just before the poet's recitation. Now he set the baby softly in the padded nest.
I'm sorry,
said Braun Lamia and lowered the small laser.
It's just that he makes me so angry.
Weintraub nodded, rocking the drawer slightly. The gentle roll of the wind wagon, combined with the incessant rumble of the great wheel, appeared to have already put the child to sleep.
We're all tired and tense. Perhaps we should find our lodgings for the night and turn in.
The woman sighed and tucked the weapon in her belt.
I won't sleep. Things are too strange.
Others nodded. Martin Silenus was sitting on the broad ledge below the stern windows. Now he pulled up his legs, took a drink, and said to Weintraub,
Tell your story, old man.
Yes, said Father Hoyt.
The priest looked exhausted to the point of being cadaverous, but his feverish eyes burned.
Tell us. We need to have the stories told and time to think about them before we arrive.
Weintraub passed a hand across his bald scalp.
It's a dull tale. I've never been to Hyperion before. There are no confrontations with monsters, no acts of heroism. It's a tale by a man whose idea of epic adventure is speaking to a class without his notes.
All the better,
said Martin Silenus.
We need a soporific.
Saul Weintraub sighed, adjusted his glasses, and nodded. There were a few streaks of dark in his beard, but most of it had gone gray. He turned the lantern low over the baby's bed and moved to a chair in the center of the room. The consul turned down the other lamps and poured more coffee for those who wanted it. Saul Weintraub's voice was slow, careful in phrase, and precise in wording. and before long, the gentle cadence of his story blended with the soft rumble and slow pitchings of the wind wagon's progress north.
The Scholar's Tale. The River Lethe's taste is bitter. Saul Weintraub and his wife Sarai had enjoyed their life even before the birth of their daughter. Rachel made things as close to perfect as the couple could imagine. Sarai was 27 when the child was conceived. Saul was 29. Neither of them had considered Poulsen treatments because neither of them could afford it. But even without such care, they looked forward to another 50 years of health. Both had lived their entire lives on Barnard's World, one of the oldest but least exciting members of the hegemony. Barnard's was in the web, but it made little difference to Saul and Sarai since they could not afford frequent Farcaster travel, and had little wish to go at any rate. Saul had recently celebrated his 10th year with Knightenhelser College, where he taught history and classical studies, and did his own research on ethical evolution. Knightenhelser was a small school, fewer than 3,000 students, but its academic reputation was outstanding, and it attracted young people from all over the web. The primary complaint of these students was that Knightenhelser and its surrounding community of Crawford constituted an island of civilization in an ocean of corn. It was true. The college was 3,000 flat kilometers away from the capital of Bassard, and the terraformed land in between was given over to farming. There had been no forests to fell, no hills to deal with, and no mountains to break the flat monotony of cornfields, bean fields, cornfields, wheat fields, cornfields, rice paddies, and cornfields. The radical poet Salmud Brevi had taught briefly at Knightenhelser before the Glennon Height Mutiny, had been fired, and, upon farcasting to Renaissance Vector, had told his friends that Crawford County, on South Sinzer on Barnard's World, constituted the eighth circle of desolation on the smallest pimple on the absolute ass end of creation. Saul and Sarai Weintraub liked it. Crawford, a town of 25,000, might have been reconstructed from some 19th century mid-American template. The streets were wide and overarched with elms and oaks. Barnard's had been the second extrasolar Earth colony, centuries before the Hawking Drive and Hegira, and the seed ships then had been huge. Homes in Crawford reflected styles ranging from early Victorian to Canadian Revival, but they all seemed to be white and set far back on well-trimmed lawns. The college itself was Georgian, an assemblage of red brick and white pillars surrounding the oval common. Saul's office was on the third floor of Placher Hall, the oldest building on campus, and in the winter he could look out on bare branches which carved the common into complex geometries. Saul loved the chalk dust and old wood smell of the place, a smell which had not changed since he was a freshman there, and each day, climbing to his office, he treasured the deeply worn grooves in the steps, a legacy of 20 generations of Knightenhelser students. Sarai had been born on a farm halfway between Bassard and Crawford, and had received her Ph.D. in music theory a year before Saul earned his doctorate. She had been a happy and energetic young woman, making up in personality what she lacked in accepted norms of physical beauty, and she carried this attractiveness of person into later life. Sarai had studied off-world for 2 years at the University of New Lyons on Deneb Dry, but she was homesick there. The sunsets were abrupt, the much-vaunted mountains slicing off the sunlight like a ragged scythe, and she longed for the hours-long sunsets of home, where Barnard's star hung on the horizon like a great tethered red balloon while the sky congealed to evening. She missed the perfect flatness where, peering from her third-floor room under the steep gables, a little girl could look 50 kilometers across tasseled fields to watch a storm approach like a bruise-black curtain lit within by lightning bolts. And Sarai missed her family. She and Saul met a week after she transferred to Knightenhelzer. It was another 3 years before he proposed marriage, and she accepted. At first, she saw nothing in the short graduate student. She was still wearing web fashions then, involved in post-destructionist music theories, reading Obit and Nihil and the most avant-garde magazines from Renaissance Vector and TC Squared, feigning sophisticated weariness with life and a rebel's vocabulary. And none of this gelled with the undersized but earnest history major who spilled fruit cocktail on her at Dean Moore's honors party. Any exotic qualities which might have come from Saul Weintraub's Jewish legacy were instantly negated by his BW accent, his Crawford Squireshop wardrobe, and the fact that he had come to the party with a copy of de Tresk's Solitude's Invariance, absent-mindedly tucked under his arm. For Saul, it was love at first sight. He stared at the laughing, red-cheeked girl and ignored the expensive dress and affected mandarin nails in favor of the personality which blazed like a beacon to the lonely junior. Saul had not known he was lonely until he met Saray, but after the first time he shook her hand and spilled fruit salad down the front of her dress, he knew that his life would be empty forever if they did not marry. They married the week after the announcement of Saul's teaching appointment at the college. Their honeymoon was on Maui Covenant, his first Farcast trip abroad, and for 3 weeks they rented a mobile isle and sailed alone on it through the wonders of the equatorial archipelago. Saul never forgot the images of those sun-drenched and wind-filled days. And the secret image he would always most cherish was of Saray rising nude from a nighttime swim, the core stars blazing above while her own body glowed constellations from the phosphorescence of the island's wake. They had wanted a child immediately, but it was to be 5 years before nature agreed. Saul remembered cradling Saray in his arms as she curled in pain. A difficult delivery, until finally, incredibly, Rachel Sarah Weintraub was born at 2:01 a.m. in Crawford County Med Center. The presence of an infant intruded upon Saul's solipsistic life as a serious academic and Saray's profession as music critic for Barnard's Datasphere, but neither minded. The first months were a blend of constant fatigue and joy. Late at night, between feedings, Saul would tiptoe into the nursery just to check on Rachel and to stand and gaze at the baby. More often than not, he would find Saray already there, and the two would watch, arm in arm, at the miracle of a baby, sleeping on its stomach, rump in the air, head burrowed into the bumper pad at the head of the crib. Rachel was one of those rare children who managed to be cute without becoming self-consciously precious. By the time she was 2 standard years old, her appearance and personality were striking. Her mother's light brown hair, red cheeks, and broad smile. Her father's large brown eyes. Friends said that the child combined the best portions of Saray's sensitivity and Saul's intellect. Another friend, a child psychologist from the college, once commented that Rachel at age 5 showed the most reliable indicators of true giftedness in a young person. Structured curiosity, empathy for others, compassion, and a fierce sense of fair play. One day in his office, studying ancient files from old Earth, Saul was reading about the effect of Beatrice on the worldview of Dante Alighieri when he was struck by a passage written by a critic from the 20th or 21st century. She, Beatrice, alone was still real for him, still implied meaning in the world and beauty. Her nature became his landmark. What Melville would call, with more sobriety than we can now muster, his Greenwich standard. Saul paused to access the definition of Greenwich standard, and then he read on. The critic had added a personal note.
Most of us, I hope, have had some child or spouse or friend like Beatrice, someone who, by his very nature, his seemingly innate goodness and intelligence, makes us uncomfortably conscious of our lies when we lie. Saul had shut off the display and gazed out at the black geometries of branches above the common. Rachel was not insufferably perfect. When she was 5 standard, she carefully cut the hair of her 5 favorite dolls, and then cut her own hair, shortest of all. When she was 7, she decided that the migrant workers staying in their run-down houses on the south end of town lacked a nutritious diet, so she emptied the house's pantries, cold boxes, freezers, and synthesizer banks, talked 3 friends into accompanying her, and distributed several 100 marks worth of the family's monthly food budget. When she was 10, Rachel responded to a dare from Stubby Berkowitz and tried to climb to the top of Crawford's oldest elm. She was 40 meters up, less than 5 meters from the top, when a branch broke and she fell 2/3 of the way to the ground. Saul was paged on his comlog while discussing the moral implications of Earth's first nuclear disarmament era, and he left the class without a word and ran the 12 blocks to the med center. Rachel had broken her left leg, 2 ribs, punctured a lung, and fractured her jaw. She was floating in a bath of recovery nutrient when Saul burst in, but she managed to look over her mother's shoulder, smile slightly, and say through the wire cast on her jaw, "Dad, I was 15 feet from the top. Maybe closer. I'll make it next time." Rachel graduated with honors from secondary tutorials and received scholarship offers from corporate academies on 5 worlds and 3 universities, including Harvard on New Earth. She chose Knighton-Helser. It was little surprise to Saul that his daughter chose archaeology as a major. One of his fondest memories of her was the long afternoons she had spent under the front porch when she was about 2, digging in the loam, ignoring spiders and googlepeds, rushing into the house to show off every plastic plate and tarnished Fennig that she had excavated, demanding to know where it had come from. What were the people like who had left it there? Rachel received her undergraduate degree when she was 19 standard, worked that summer on her grandmother's farm, and farcast away the next fall. She was at Rijks University on Freeholm for 28 local months, and when she returned, it was as if color had flowed back into Saul and Saray's world. For 2 weeks, their daughter, an adult now, self-aware and secure in some ways that grown-ups twice her age often failed to be, rested and reveled in being home. One evening, walking across the campus just after sunset, she pressed her father on details of his heritage. "Dad, do you still consider yourself a Jew?" Saul had run his hand over his thinning hair, surprised by the question. "A Jew? Yes, I suppose so. It doesn't mean what it once did, though." "Am I a Jew?" asked Rachel. Her cheeks glowed in the fragile light. "If you want to be," said Saul. "It doesn't have the same significance with old Earth gone." "If I'd been a boy, would you have had me circumcised?" Saul had laughed, delighted and embarrassed by the question. "I'm serious," said Rachel. Saul adjusted his glasses. "I guess I would have, kiddo. I never thought about it." "Have you been to the synagogue in Basard?"
"Not since my bar mitzvah," said Saul.
Thinking back to the day 50 years earlier, when his father had borrowed Uncle Richard's Vicken and had flown the family to the capital for the ritual. "Dad, why do Jews feel that things are less important now than before the Hegira?" Saul spread his hands, strong hands, more those of a stoneworker than an academic. "That's a good question, Rachel. Probably because so much of the dream is dead. Israel is gone. The new temple
lasted less time than the first and second. God broke his word by destroying the earth a second time in the way he did. And this diaspora is forever. But Jews maintain their ethnic and religious identity in some places, his daughter insisted. Oh, sure. On Hebron and isolated areas of the concourse, you can find entire communities. Hasidic, Orthodox, Hasmonean, you name it. But they tend to be non-vital, picturesque, tourist-oriented. Like a theme park. Yes. Could you take me to Temple Beth-El tomorrow? I can borrow Khaki's strat. No need, said Saul. We'll use the college's shuttle. He paused. Yes, he said at last. I would like to take you to the synagogue tomorrow. It was getting dark under the old elms. Streetlights came on up and down the wide lane which led to their home. Dad, said Rachel, I'm going to ask you a question I've asked about a million times since I was two. Do you believe in God? Saul had not smiled. He had no choice but to give her the answer he had given her a million times. I'm waiting to, he said. Rachel's postgraduate work dealt with alien and pre-Hegira artifacts. For 3 standard years, Saul and Saray would receive occasional visits, followed by fatline flimsies from exotic worlds near but not within the web. They all knew that her fieldwork in quest of dissertation would soon take her beyond the web, into the outback, where time debt ate away at the lives and memories of those left behind. Where the hell is Hyperion? Saray had asked during Rachel's last vacation before the expedition left. Sounds like a brand name for some new household product. It's a great place, Mom. There are more non-human artifacts there than any place except Armagast. Well, then why not go to Armagast, said Saray. It's only a few months from the web. Why settle for second best? Hyperion hasn't become the big tourist attraction yet, said Rachel, although they're beginning to become a problem. People with money are more willing to travel outside the web now. Saul had found his voice suddenly husky. Will you be going to the labyrinth or the artifacts called the Time Tombs? The Time Tombs, Dad. I'll be working with Dr. Emilio Arendez, and he knows more about the tombs than anyone alive. Aren't they dangerous? Asked Saul, framing the question as casually as he could, but hearing the edge in his voice. Rachel smiled. Because of the Shrike legend? No. Nobody's been bothered by that particular legend for 2 standard centuries. But I've seen documents about the trouble there during the second colonization, began Saul. Me too, Dad, but they didn't know about the big rock eels that came down into the desert to hunt. They probably lost a few people to those things and panicked. You know how legends begin. Besides, the rock eels have been hunted to extinction. Spacecraft don't land there, persisted Saul. You have to sail to the tombs, or hike, or some damn thing. Rachel laughed. In the early days, people flying in underestimated the effects of the anti-entropic fields, and there were some accidents. But there's dirigible service now. They have a big hotel called Keep Kronos at the north edge of the mountains, where hundreds of tourists a year stay. Will you be staying there? Asked Saray. Part of the time. It'll be exciting, Mom. Not too exciting, I hope, said Saray. And all of them had smiled. During the 4 years that Rachel was in transit, a few weeks of cryogenic fugue for her, Saul found that he missed his daughter much more than if she had been out of touch but busy somewhere in the web. The thought that she was flying away from him faster than the speed of light, wrapped in the artificial quantum cocoon of the Hawking effect, seemed unnatural and ominous to him. They kept busy. Saray retired from the critic business to devote more time to local environmental issues, but for Saul, it was one of the most hectic times of his life. His second and third books came out, and the second one, Moral Turning Points,
caused such a stir that he was in constant demand at off-world conferences and symposia. He traveled to a few alone, to a few more with Saray, but although both of them enjoyed the idea of traveling, the actual experience of facing strange foods, different gravities, and the light from strange suns all paled after a while, and Saul found himself spending more time at home researching his next book, attending conferences if he had to, via Interactive Hollow from the college. It was almost 5 years after Rachel left on her expedition that Saul had a dream which would change his life. Saul dreamed that he was wandering through a great structure with columns the size of small redwood trees and a ceiling lost to sight far above him, through which red light fell in solid shafts. At times, he caught glimpses of things far off in the gloom to his left or right. Once, he made out a pair of stone legs rising like massive buildings through the darkness. Another time, he spied what appeared to be a crystal scarab, rotating far above him, its insides ablaze with cool lights. Finally, Saul stopped to rest. Far behind him, he could hear what sounded like a great conflagration, entire cities and forests burning. Ahead of him glowed the lights he'd been walking toward, two ovals of deepest red. He was mopping sweat from his brow when an immense voice said to him, "Saul, take your daughter, your only daughter Rachel, whom you love, and go to the world called Hyperion, and offer her there as a burnt offering at one of the places of which I shall tell you." And in his dream Saul had stood and said, "You can't be serious." And he had walked on through darkness, the red orbs glowing now like bloody moons, hanging above an indistinct plain, and when he stopped to rest, the immense voice said, "Saul, take your daughter, your only daughter Rachel, whom you love, and go to the world called Hyperion, and offer her there as a burnt offering at one of the places of which I shall tell you." And Saul had shrugged off the weight of the voice and had said distinctly into the darkness, "I heard you the first time. The answer is still no." Saul knew he was dreaming then, and part of his mind enjoyed the irony of the script, but another part wanted only to waken. Instead, he found himself on a low balcony, looking down on a room where Rachel lay naked on a broad block of stone. The scene was illuminated by the glow of the twin red orbs. Saul looked down at his right hand and found a long, curved knife there. The blade and handle appeared to be made of bone. The voice, sounding more than ever to Saul like some cut-rate Holly director's shallow idea of what God's voice should sound like, came again. "Saul, you must listen well. The future of humankind depends upon your obedience in this matter. You must take your daughter Rachel, whom you love, and go to the world called Hyperion, and offer her there as a burnt offering at one of the places of which I shall tell you." And Saul, sick of the whole dream, yet somehow alarmed by it, had turned and thrown the knife far into the darkness. When he turned back to find his daughter, the scene had faded. The red orbs hung closer than ever, and now Saul could see that they were multifaceted gems, the size of small worlds. The amplified voice came again. "So, you have had your chance, Saul Weintraub. If you change your mind, you know where to find me." And Saul awakened, half laughing, half chilled by the dream, amused by the thought that the entire Talmud and the Old Testament might be nothing more than a cosmic, shaggy dog story. About the time Saul was having his dream, Rachel was on Hyperion, finishing her first year of research there. The team of 9 archaeologists and 6 physicists had found Keep Kronos fascinating, but far too crowded with tourists and would-be Shrike pilgrims, So after the first month spent commuting from the hotel, they had set up a permanent camp between the ruined city and the small canyon holding the time tombs. While half the team excavated the more recent site of the unfinished city, two of Rachel's colleagues helped her catalog every aspect of the tombs. The physicists were fascinated with the anti-entropic fields and spent much of their time setting small flags of different colors to mark the limits of the so-called time tides. Rachel's team concentrated their work in the structure called the Sphinx. Although the creature represented in stone was neither human nor lion, it may not have been a creature at all, although the smooth lines atop the stone monolith suggested curves of a living thing, and the sweeping appendages made everyone think of wings. Unlike the other tombs, which lay open and were easily inspected, the Sphinx was a mass of heavy blocks, honeycombed with narrow corridors, some of which tightened to impossibility, some of which widened to auditorium-sized proportions, but none of which led anywhere but back on themselves. There were no crypts, treasure rooms, plundered sarcophagi, wall murals, or secret passages, merely a maze of senseless corridors through sweating stone. Rachel and her lover, Emilio Arandes, began mapping the Sphinx using a method which had been in use for at least 700 years, having been pioneered in the Egyptian pyramids sometime in the 20th century. Arranging sensitive radiation and cosmic ray detectors at the lowest point in the Sphinx, they recorded arrival times and deflection patterns of the particles passing through the mass of stone above them, watching for hidden rooms or passages which would not show up even on deep imaging radar. Because of the busy tourist season and the concern of the Hyperion Home Rule Council that the tombs might be damaged by such research, Rachel and Emilio went out to their site every night at midnight, making the half-hour walk and crawl through the corridor maze which they had rigged with blue glow globes. There, sitting under hundreds of thousands of tons of stone, they would watch their instruments until morning, listening to their earphones ping with the sound of particles born in the belly of dying stars. The time tides had not been a problem with the Sphinx. Of all the tombs, it seemed the least protected by the anti-entropic fields, and the physicists had carefully mapped the times when the tide surges might pose a threat. High tide was at 1000 hours, receding only 20 minutes later back toward the Jade Tomb, half a kilometer to the south. Tourists were not allowed near the Sphinx until after 1200 hours, and to leave a margin of safety, the site made sure they were out by 0900. The physics team had planted chronotropic sensors at various points along the paths and walkways between the tombs, both to alert the monitors to variations of the tides and to warn the visitors. With only 3 weeks to go of her year of research on Hyperion, Rachel awoke one night, left her sleeping lover, and took a ground-effect jeep from the camp to the tombs. She and Emilio had decided that it was foolish for both of them to monitor the equipment every night. Now they alternated, one working at the site while the other collected data and prepared for the final project, a radar mapping of the dunes between the Jade Tomb and the obelisk. The night was cool and beautiful. A profusion of stars stretched from horizon to horizon, 4 or 5 times the number Rachel had grown up looking at from Barnard's world. The low dunes whispered and shifted in the strong breeze blowing from the mountains in the south. Rachel found lights still burning at the site. The physics team was just calling it a day and loading their own jeep. She chatted with them, had a cup of coffee as they drove away, and then took her backpack and made the 25-minute trip into the basement of the Sphinx. For the 100th time, Rachel wondered who had built the tombs, and for what purpose. Dating of the construction materials had been useless because of the effect of the anti-entropic field. Only analysis of the tombs in relation to the erosion of the canyon and other surrounding geological features had suggested an age of at least 500,000 years. The feeling was that the architects of the time tombs had been humanoid, even though nothing but the gross scale of the structures suggested such a thing. Certainly the passageways in the Sphinx revealed little. Some were human enough in size and shape, but then meters farther along the same corridor might dwindle to a tube the size of a sewer pipe, and then transform itself into something larger and more random than a natural cavern. Doorways, if they could be called such, since they opened to nothing in particular, might be triangular, or trapezoidal, or ten-sided, as commonly as rectangular. Rachel crawled the last 20 meters down a steep slope, sliding her backpack ahead of her. The heatless glow globes gave the rock in her flesh a bluish, bloodless cast. The basement, when she reached it, seemed a haven of human clutter and smells. Several folding chairs filled the center of the small space, while detectors, oscilloscopes, and other paraphernalia lined the narrow table against the north wall. A plank on sawhorses along the opposite wall held coffee cups, a chess set, a half-eaten donut, two paperbacks, and a plastic toy of some sort of dog in a grass skirt. Rachel settled in, set her coffee therm next to the toy, and checked the cosmic ray detectors. The data appeared to be the same. No hidden rooms or passages. Just a few niches even the deep radar had missed. In the morning, Melio and Stefan would set a deep probe working, getting an imager filament in and sampling the air before digging further with a micro-manipulator. So far, a dozen such niches had turned up nothing of interest. The joke at camp was that the next hole, no bigger than a fist, would reveal miniature sarcophagi, undersized urns, a petite mummy, or, as Melio put it, a teeny-tiny Tutankhamun. Out of habit, Rachel tried the comlinks on her comlog. Nothing. 40 meters of stone tended to do that. They had talked of stringing telephone wire from the basement to the surface, but there had been no pressing need, and now their time was almost up. Rachel adjusted the input channels on her comlog to monitor the detector data, and then settled back for a long, boring night. There was a wonderful story of the old Earth pharaoh, was it Cheops, who authorized his huge pyramid, agreed to the burial chamber being deep under the center of the thing, and then lay awake nights for years in a claustrophobic panic, thinking of all those tons of stone above him for all eternity. Eventually, the pharaoh ordered the burial chamber repositioned 2/3 the way up the Great Pyramid. Most unorthodox. Rachel could understand the king's position. She hoped that, wherever he was, he slept better now. Rachel was almost dozing herself when, at 02:15, her comlog chirped, the detectors screamed, and she jumped to her feet. According to the sensors, the Sphinx had suddenly grown a dozen new chambers, some larger than the total structure. Rachel keyed displays and the air misted with models that changed as she watched. Corridor schematics twisted back on themselves like rotating Mobius strips. The external sensors indicated the upper structure twisting and bending like polyflex in the wind, or like wings. Rachel knew that it was some type of multiple malfunction, but even as she tried to recalibrate, she called data and impressions into her comlog. Then, several things happened at once. She heard the drag of feet in the corridor above her. All of the displays went dead simultaneously. Somewhere in the maze of corridors, a time-tied alarm began to blare. All of the lights went off. This final event made no sense. The instrument packages held their own power supplies and would have stayed lighted through a nuclear attack. The lamp they used in the basement had a new 10-year power cell. The glow globes in the corridors were bioluminescent and needed no power. Nonetheless, the lights were out. Rachel pulled a flashlight laser out of the knee pocket of her jumpsuit and triggered it. Nothing happened. For the first time in her life, terror closed on Rachel Weintraub like a hand on her heart. She could not breathe. For 10 seconds, she willed herself to be absolutely still, not even listening, merely waiting for the panic to recede. When it had subsided enough for her to breathe without gasping, she felt her way to the instruments and keyed them. They did not respond. She lifted her comm log and thumbed the disky. Nothing. Which was impossible, of course, given the solid-state invulnerability and power cell reliability of the thing. Still, nothing. Rachel could hear her pulse pounding now, but she again fought back the panic and began feeling her way toward the only exit. The thought of finding her way through the maze in absolute darkness made her want to scream, but she could think of no other alternatives. Wait. There had been old lights throughout the Sphinx maze, but the research team had strung the glow globes. Strung them. There was a Perlon line connecting them all the way to the surface. Fine. Rachel groped her way toward the exit, feeling the cold stone under her fingers. Was it this cold before? There came a clear sound of something sharp scraping its way down the access shaft. Melio? Called Rachel into the blackness. Tanya! Kurt? The scraping sounded very close. Rachel backed away, knocking over an instrument and chair in the blackness. Something touched her hair, and she gasped, raised her hand. The ceiling was lower. The solid block of stone 5 meters square slid lower even as she raised her other hand to touch it. The opening to the corridor was halfway up the wall. Rachel staggered toward it, swinging her hands in front of her like a blind person. She tripped over a folding chair, found the instrument table, followed it to the far wall, felt the bottom of the corridor shaft disappearing as the ceiling came lower. She pulled back her fingers a second before they were sliced off. Rachel sat down in the darkness. An oscilloscope scraped against the ceiling until the table cracked and collapsed under it. Rachel moved her head in short, desperate arcs. There was a metallic rasp, almost a breathing sound, less than a meter from her. She began to back away, sliding across a floor suddenly filled with broken equipment. The breathing grew louder. Something sharp and infinitely cold grasped her wrist. Rachel screamed at last. There was no fatline transmitter on Hyperion in those days, nor did the spinship HS Faro City have FTLCOM capability. So the first Saul and Saray heard of their daughter's accident was when the Hegemony Consulate on Parvati fatlined the college that Rachel had been injured, that she was stable but unconscious, and that she was being transferred from Parvati to the web world of Renaissance Vector via medical torch ship. The trip would take a little over 10 days ship time with a 5-month time debt. Those 5 months were agony for Saul and his wife, and by the time the medical ship put in at the Renaissance Farcaster Nexus, they had imagined the worst 1,000 times. It had been 8 years since they had last seen Rachel. The med center in Da Vinci was a floating tower sustained by direct broadcast power. The view over the Como Sea was breathtaking, but neither Saul nor Saray had time for it as they went from level to level in search of their daughter. Dr. Singh and Melio Arendez met them in the hub of intensive care. Introductions were rushed. Rachel? Asked Saray. Asleep, said Dr. Singh. She was a tall woman, aristocratic, but with kind eyes. As far as we can tell, Rachel has suffered no physical, injury. But she has been unconscious now for some 17 standard weeks, her time. Only in the past 10 days have her brainwaves registered deep sleep rather than coma.
I don't understand, said Sol. Was there an accident at the site? A concussion? Something happened, said Melio Arendez, but we're not sure what. Rachel was in one of the artifacts, alone. Her comlog and other instruments recorded nothing out of the ordinary, but there was a surge in a phenomenon there known as anti-entropic fields. The time tides, said Sol. We know about them. Go on. Arendez nodded and opened his hands as if molding air. There was a field surge, more like a tsunami than a tide. The Sphinx, the artifact Rachel was in, was totally inundated. I mean, there was no physical damage, but Rachel was unconscious when we found her. He turned to Dr. Singh for help. Your daughter was in a coma, said the doctor. It was not possible to put her into cryogenic fugue in that condition. So she came through quantum leap without fugue? Demanded Sol. He had read about the psychological damage to travelers who had experienced the Hawking effect directly. No, no, soothed Singh. She was unconscious in a way which shielded her quite as well as fugue state. Is she hurt? Demanded Saray. We don't know, said Singh. All life signs have returned to near normal. Brainwave activity is nearing a conscious state. The problem is that her body appears to have absorbed, that is, the anti-entropic field appears to have contaminated her. Sol rubbed his forehead. Like radiation sickness? Dr. Singh hesitated. Not precisely. This case is quite unprecedented. Specialists in aging diseases are due in this afternoon from Tau Ceti Center, Lussis, and Metaxas. Sol met the woman's gaze. Doctor, are you saying that Rachel contracted some aging disease on Hyperion? He paused a second to search his memory. Something like Methuselah syndrome or early Alzheimer's disease. No, said Singh. In fact, your daughter's illness has no name. The medics here are calling it Merlin's sickness. You see, your daughter is aging at a normal rate, but as far as we can tell, she is aging backward. Saray pulled away from the group and stared at Singh as if the doctor were insane. I want to see my daughter, she said quietly but very firmly. I want to see Rachel now. Rachel awakened less than 40 hours after Sol and Saray arrived. Within minutes, she was sitting up in bed, talking even while the medics and technicians bustled around her. Mom, Dad, what are you doing here? Before either could answer, she looked around her and blinked. Wait a minute. Where's here? Are we in Keats? Her mother took her hand. We're in a hospital in Da Vinci, dear, on Renaissance Vector. Rachel's eyes widened almost comically. Renaissance? We're in the web? She looked around her in total bewilderment. Rachel, what is the last thing you remember? Asked Dr. Singh. The young woman looked uncomprehendingly at the medic. The last thing I remember going to sleep next to Melio after... She glanced at her parents and touched her cheeks with the tips of her fingers. Melio! The others, are they? Everyone on the expedition is all right, soothed Dr. Singh. You had a slight accident. About 17 weeks have passed. You're back in the web, safe. Everyone in your party is all right. 17 weeks? Under the fading remnant of her tan, Rachel went very pale. Sol took her hand. How do you feel, kiddo? The return pressure on his fingers was heartbreakingly weak. I don't know, Daddy, she managed. Tired, dizzy, confused. Saray sat on the bed and put her arms around her. It's all right, baby. Everything's going to be all right.
Melio entered the room, unshaven, his hair rumpled from the nap he had been taking in the outer lounge. Rach? Rachel looked at him from the safety of her mother's arm. Hi, she said, almost shyly. I'm back. Saul's opinion had been, and continued to be, that medicine hadn't really changed much since the days of leeches and poultices. Nowadays they whirred one in centrifuges, realigned the body's magnetic field, bombarded the victim with sonic waves, tapped into the cells to interrogate the RNA, and then admitted their ignorance without actually coming out and saying so. The only thing that had changed was that the bills were bigger. He was dozing in a chair when Rachel's voice awoke him. Daddy? He sat up, reached for her hand. Here, kiddo. Where am I, Dad? What's happened? You're in a hospital on Renaissance, baby. There was an accident on Hyperion. You're all right now, except it's affecting your memory a bit. Rachel clung to his hand. A hospital? In the web? How'd I get here? How long have I been here? About 5 weeks, whispered Saul. What's the last thing you remember, Rachel? She sat back on her pillows and touched her forehead, feeling the tiny sensors there. Emilio and I had been at the meeting, talking with the team about setting up the search equipment in the Sphinx. Oh, Dad, I haven't told you about Emilio. He's... Yes, said Saul, and handed Rachel her comlog. Here, kiddo, listen to this. He left the room. Rachel touched the disky and blinked as her own voice began talking to her. Okay, Rach, you just woke up. You're confused. You don't know how you got here. Well, something's happened to you, kid. Listen up. I'm recording this on the 12th day of 10-month, year 457 of the Hegira, A.D. 2739, Old Reckoning. Yes, I know that's half a standard year from the last thing you remember. Listen. Something happened in the Sphinx. You got caught up in the time tide. It changed you. You're aging backward, as dumb as that sounds. Your body's getting younger every minute, although that's not the important part right now. When you sleep, when we sleep, you forget. You lose another day from your memory before the accident, and you lose everything since. Don't ask me why. The doctors don't know. The experts don't know. If you want an analogy, just think of a tapeworm virus, one of the old kind, that's chewing up the data in your comm log, backward from the last entry. They don't know why the memory loss hits you when you sleep either. They tried stay awakes, but after about 30 hours you just go catatonic for a while and the virus does its thing anyway. So, what the hell? You know something? This talking about yourself in the third person is sort of therapeutic. Actually, I'm lying here, waiting for them to take me up to imaging, knowing I'll fall asleep when I get back. Knowing I'll forget everything again. And it scares the shit out of me. Okay, key the disky for short term, and you get a prepared spiel here that should catch you up on everything since the accident. Oh, Mom and Dad are both here, and they know about Emilio. But I don't know as much as I used to. When did we first make love with him, hmm? The second month on Hyperion? Then we have just a few weeks left, Rachel. And then we'll be just acquaintances. Enjoy your memories while you can, girl. This is yesterday's Rachel, signing off. Saul came in to find his daughter sitting upright in the bed, still grasping the comm log tightly, her face pale and terrified. Daddy. He went to sit next to her and let her cry, for the 20th night.